Works better when I turn it on. Well, we've all had a nice visit. Welcome to our study of the flood, Noah's Ark, and all of the various parts of that story that go together. Last week we looked at examples of it in the book of Revelation. One possible interpretation of that book says that chapters 5, 6, and 7 have to do with the flood, and we went through that last week. And so today we're going to look at an interesting question. If God used natural phenomena, what do we mean by that? Does God ever use natural phenomena to accomplish his purposes? Actually, most of the devastations brought against Egypt by Moses were natural sorts of things. The wind blew in a herd of grasshoppers, and they ate up everything. And then at Moses' bidding, then the locusts were all carried out to sea. And so some of those plagues were miraculous, turning the water into blood. That's not a natural thing. So sometimes it's a mix of things, isn't it? And so we see natural phenomena. One very interesting one that always caught my attention in the 23rd chapter of Exodus, you can look it up, where God talks about routing the enemy by sending in a swarm of hornets. That would be disconcerting to be trying to fight a battle and having bees and hornets and wasps all around you. So sometimes he uses natural phenomena. So today we're going to look at some possibilities in connection with the flood. Now, we've already established that there is an ark. There's a big boat sitting up there above a mile elevation, above sea level, in eastern Turkey, just 25 miles south of Mount Ararat, sitting on a precipice near the top of a smaller mountain, sliding down through a gorge very slowly over time. It's fossilized. The wood in it has turned to stone. But it's clearly a boat, and it was discovered over 50 years ago. And so it's been there for a long, long time. And we established that the length of it is exactly what you would expect if it's 300 cubits long. So the explanations of how it got there and what it is have to be pretty bizarre if you don't believe in Noah's Ark and the flood. So the evidence is in favor of the fact that there was a flood that raised that boat to a very high point, and then the water went down and left it stranded on a mountain. And it's been there all along, and in fact the ancients had references to it, of pilgrims going to see the Ark. Even in the time of Christ, there were stories about that, and a few written records attesting to the fact that it was still there. So we're not talking today about any evidence that it happened. We're talking about how could it have happened? What are the possibilities if God used natural phenomena? Now, you can always say, "Let there be water," or "let there be rain," and take care of that. And if that's what you want to look at, want to believe, that's fine. But scientists, people that you talk to about this thing, because we're going to show in the next couple of lessons how very important this is to science in our world. And so the people that you talk to would like to see some natural phenomena associated with it, and the fact that God probably did use mostly natural phenomena in bringing this event about is pretty interesting. So it'll be interesting to someone you're talking to, and it's interesting to me as a scientist, and so you're stuck with me for another 45 minutes here. Follow along with this. It gets to be a little bit, it's just so stories. You've heard these before, haven't you? If it's just so, this could account for it. But we're not trying to make a natural explanation of something that God did. The miracles are largely involved in the element of timing. Moses tells Pharaoh, this is going to happen if you don't let the people go. Pharaoh resists, and it happens. So the timing is what makes it a miracle. In many of those cases, even though lice or flies or frogs or whatever they are happen naturally, they don't happen in the large volume of the event and also at the timing that it was intended. And so the same goes for calling them off. When Pharaoh says, okay, I give, uncle, and so Moses calls the plague off, and it disappears on cue. So that's some of the miraculous element of it. We're going to talk about comets. That's where we left you last week, because I think there's a comet involved in this story. In Revelation, we saw, and we'll look at that in a minute, that there was a star fall, that is, a real intense meteor shower. And that's not the only place in the Bible where that sort of thing happens. There's one other case that needs to be mentioned in the 8th chapter. I don't have it on the screen, but I'll read it to you, where there's a series of devastations brought upon the earth after the flood. The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. That's an interesting name. I'm not sure the derivation of wormwood. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. So it poisoned the water supply for a lot of people. That sounds like a comet, doesn't it? And an event like that, that's a huge event, and a lot of people are affected, often gets a name. And the name of that star, that comet apparently that struck the earth, maybe it was a comet, maybe it sounds like it, since he said it was a torch. But it could have been also not necessarily a comet, but a rock. What do we call it? A meteor, yeah. And that's a good enough term. Okay. My mind is a little foggy this morning. Okay. So here was the information about the flood that we got from Genesis. And the things that are in blue have to do with the world before the flood. The earth was warm and humid with a daily mist, and there was no wind and no rain. And we'll look at the scripture for that in a moment. The springs of the great deep burst forth, whatever those are. The floodgates of heaven were opened. You see, we aren't told what those things are, but there seems to be in the mind of Moses, and as he writes this, and certainly in Noah, these were terms that they used. Rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and it's interesting that they don't choose another name for rain, because they probably had never seen rain. And the waters flooded the earth for 150 days. So we get all of that information about the flood from Genesis. Now, if we go to Revelation, we see some more information. There was a great earthquake. And the sun and the moon were darkened, and a heavy starfall, that is a meteor shower, occurred. The sky disappeared. The mountains and islands collapsed. The humanity fled to caves in the mountains, and they knew about the wrath of the Lamb, and there was no wind before the flood. And that refers to the time before the flood. Everything else on here has to do with when the flood occurred. And so we looked at that in some detail last week, and the reasons why we think that has to do with the flood. The main thing in that are the last three down there, that the humanity fled to caves in the mountains. This is the population before the flood, a huge population, and it sounds like rising water, doesn't it, is that they go to the mountains. Now, it says the mountains and islands collapsed. They were collapsing, I think, is the concept here. And the taller mountains, there had been caves in them, and they were trying to protect themselves from the wild animals, which also were fleeing the flood. And then we talked last week about the fact that there was something about Jesus and the, being the Lamb and being known to those people. Even though we don't know the relationship that he had with them, it seems to have something to do with their salvation. And then the one about there's no wind before the flood was the thing that's particularly interesting to me, because it was something I was trying to solve in thinking about natural phenomena in a world that didn't have any wind. And that's the one that turns out to be miraculous. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. And that seems to be the case, as God was, the angel of God, was marking the righteous up until the time in which the flood came. And so, holding back the wind, it was such an unnatural situation. If you think about that, just from the standpoint of science, we have an earth turning at the equator. Now, it's 25,000 miles in circumference, right? And I don't think the size of the earth changed in any of this. And it's rotating once a day. And so at the equator, the speed of rotation of the earth is about 1,000 miles an hour. And if you've flown to Europe and or to Asia and back, you know that the rotation of the earth exceeds the speed at which your jet airliner goes if you're crossing near the equator. Now, if you get further up in the northern latitudes, the speed of the turn is less, and so you can fly from England back to the United States, and time pretty much stands still, doesn't it? Because you're going at the same rate that the earth is turning. So, how do you get a rotating object like this dragging its fluid atmosphere behind it without any wind? That's a real critical problem, and God evidently stationed angels to make sure that the wind didn't blow, because if it did blow, it would precipitate, it would stir up dust, precipitate the rain, the moisture in the atmosphere, and cause rain. And just for one thing, it would, if there were clouds, create clouds and make rain, then there would be rainbows, and he wasn't ready to give the rainbow, was he? That comes after the flood. So we're pretty sure there wasn't any rain before the flood. So that was a particular thing that caught my eye as I was studying Revelation, and I said, hey, that's the time, that's the explanation for why there was no wind before the flood, because God made sure that there was no wind. There's another reference in Revelation to an angel standing in the sun, which suggests to me that he's regulating the release of energy on the earth. And so God has helpers to keep our solar system and our universe organized to make it habitable for us. Now, back in Genesis, there are several things about the world before the flood. In the second chapter, in verses 4 to 6, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, no shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, no plant of the field had yet sprung up. He's talking about crops here, I think. And the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no man to work the ground. Okay, so he's talking about what Adam is going to be doing for him later on. But streams, it says in the NIV, but the word there is clearly a mist or a fog. I don't know why the NIV translated that as spring. I think it's because it did talk about later on about there was a water coming out of the ground forming the headwaters for four rivers. And that obviously had some effect on watering the ground, but here the word is a mist. came up from the earth and watered the whole surface of the ground. And apparently that's what happens if the atmosphere is saturated with water. Then a slight drop in temperature causes us to have a fog. We experience that a lot here in Houston. And then as daylight approaches and the weather warms just a degree or two, then the mist evaporates. Otherwise, you would see rainbows in the mist. So it's a nighttime phenomenon, you see. So that still looks like natural phenomena. Now, the one in the creation in the first chapter of Genesis that's interesting here in relation to where did the water come from for the flood. God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So the earth, as he starts making it habitable, the ground, the land evidently is completely covered. And there's just the deep covers the entire world. And so he's going to bring dry land up out of the water. And so he takes part of the water and raises it and puts an atmosphere underneath it. God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so, and God called the expanse sky. So we know we're talking here about the atmosphere. So he takes part of the water and puts it on top of the atmosphere, and part of it is underneath. The part that's underneath is what? God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let the dry ground appear. And it was so, and God called the dry ground land, and he called the gathered waters seas. And so now you have oceans and dry land. And God saw that it was good. Well, how do you put the water above the atmosphere? And at first glance, that sounds ridiculous. But when you look at the physics of it, it isn't. This is the picture that we get. And remember, we're talking about a time before the earth was divided. We spent some time looking at that a few weeks ago. So it's all one continent. And here you've got rivers. I put four rivers flowing out of Eden in the upper center part of Pangaea. That means all of the earth. Pan means all, and Gaia is the scientific name for the earth. So all one landmass, four rivers that run to the ocean, and there's air in between water above the atmosphere and water below it, which of course is the sea. So that's the picture of the world before the flood. So how does the water float on top of the atmosphere? Well, it turns out that water vapor is the lightest of the abundant gases in our atmosphere. If you look at the atomic weights and the molecular weights of the major gases here, nitrogen, oxygen make up the biggest part of it, and you've heard that as 40 and as 80 and 20%, 20% oxygen, 80% nitrogen, and roughly that's true because the water vapor never is calculated in the composition of the atmosphere. And the reason for that is that it varies. And so today is a dry day, and the relative humidity is low, and so the percent water in our atmosphere is very low. And just before it rains and it gets to be sticky outside, then the water vapor is high, and so When it gets saturated, 100% humidity, then the water vapor is about 4%, a sizable part of our atmosphere. But the water vapor is the lightest of the gases. Nitrogen and oxygen are heavier, and carbon dioxide, which stays down pretty much on the surface of the earth, is even heavier. And so of the abundant gases, water is the lightest. And so the vapor, as long as it isn't condensed into water droplets, can float on top of our atmosphere. And that's kind of curious, kind of interesting, isn't it? And as a matter of fact, as NASA has gone studied our atmosphere and our world from outer space and so on, they know that there is abundant water on the surface of the atmosphere, on the outer surface of it. Part of the problem there is it's evaporating into space. The Earth is gradually drying, and a lot of planets have dried. We read about that in connection with Mars. It seems to be dry now. Most of its moisture has escaped. But surprisingly there, they've discovered there's a lot of it frozen under the ground. So putting water on top of the atmosphere is not so outlandish after all. In our world that we have now, we know that that water is not up there anymore. There's some, but not anything like the picture that we get in the first chapter of Genesis, that the water above and separated from the water below. So now we have clouds. Most of our water is either in the oceans or in the formation of clouds, and clouds are down close to the ground. You fly in an airplane, you realize that. You get above the clouds and there's no weather up there. Now from Revelation we get a couple of things that suggest to us a comet. And that's where we finished last week. A great comet. Imagine with me the picture here if it is a comet. The atmosphere before the flood didn't have any clouds, so it was every day was a clear day. You wake up and the sun comes up, goes across the sky and goes down, and there aren't any clouds to obscure it. But at nighttime, likewise, there's no clouds to obscure the stars and the moon, if the moon's up at night. Half of the time it is. But you can see all the stars, and all at once they begin to notice there's one star that's getting brighter and brighter and brighter as the days go by, as a comet approaches the Earth. Now it's coming from the outer reaches of our solar system. There is a reservoir of frozen water out beyond the orbit of Pluto called the Oort cloud, and there's some even beyond that. They aren't sure how far out it extends, where there are thousands and thousands of comets circulating in orbits around the sun, but they interact with one another from time to time, bang into each other, and some of them get deflected to the inner solar system. Many of them interact with Jupiter or Saturn, those giant planets in the outer part of our solar system, and that protects us somewhat from comets that come in, and asteroids as well. That was the word I was looking for a while ago, asteroids. Well, the fact that there was a great earthquake and a heavy starfall suggests that a comet is involved in the phenomenon just before the flood. So let's see how that works. Scientists think that scientists who look at this natural phenomenon thing in the extreme and say, okay, where did all the water in our oceans come from? Earth is covered with water, isn't it? Essentially, 3/4 of the surface of the Earth is liquid, and only 1/4 or 1/5 of it is land. And so the comets brought in their view, over eons of time, brought in most of the water and collisions with the Earth. Particularly, there was a heavy bombardment of the Earth in its early days, according to their ideas. Well, the anatomy of a comet, it has a core. They think most of them do have a core, a rocky core, around which is assembled a huge mass of ice and dust and gravel that it's picked up, accreted is the term there, and as it circulates in the outer reaches of our solar system. And it's very cold. It's approaching absolute zero out there. And so it comes in, as it gets closer to the sun, some of the ice melts and releases dust and gravel into a tail here that always points away from the sun, because the comet is also being bombarded with the solar wind. We didn't know anything about solar wind until the last 50 years, but that's a pretty sizable force on a large body. And this thing may be 10 or 20 miles across, so it's a pretty good size object. So there's a lot of ice packed around the core, and some of it is being released as a gas in what's called the gas tail and the dust tail. And these often separate because the gas tail follows in the wake of the comet in the direction that it's actually moving. The gas tail or the dust tail always points directly behind the comet. All right, so that's kind of what it looks like. And it carries, each comet may carry a huge amount of water with it. We look at that thing in the sky and say, well, that's just a small star, but really it's a big one. And as the ancients saw this comet approaching the Earth, and then this excuse me, this devastation occurs, the idea that comets are bad news may have originated with this event. And so comets historically have been omens of evil, omens of disaster. And maybe from the survivors of the flood, that story got started. Okay, let's move on. So here's a comet. I'm not sure which one this is, actually, but here's the dust tail going up this way, and all of this out here is the gas tail. A lot of the material is released as gases, mostly water vapor. Now, when a comet passes by the Earth, if it's far enough away, nothing much happens. We get to see it, and the great comet, Halley's Comet, has been viewed many times because it comes and it's predictable. When it comes in its elliptical orbit around the sun, it comes every 72 years, I think, something like that. But if a comet gets too close to the Earth, it interacts gravitationally with the Earth. What that means is, if it gets within, there was a Dr. Roche who figured this out, there's a limit for the Earth. If a comet comes within 6,000 miles of the surface of the Earth, it will disintegrate. A bigger planet, it will disintegrate further out. We'll talk about that in a minute because we've witnessed this happen in our lifetime. The comet comes in from outer space, comes zooming past the Earth, and when it gets within this limit, the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the comet just falls apart because it's really like a flying gravel pit. I mean, there's not much holding all of the pieces together. And so the ice is in small particles, and so it just disintegrates. And all of the ice goes into orbit around the Earth here and then eventually falls into the Earth. The core of the comet may go on. And the curious thing is that in some cases the comet still is slowed somewhat by the Earth's gravity, comes back and impacts the Earth. You say, well, what's the possibility of that happening? Actually, it was witnessed in the case of Jupiter, and I want to show you just very briefly how that happened in the early 90s. I don't know, did any of you see that? I'm something of an astronomer nut, and so I have a telescope, and when I found out this was happening, I got it out and I watched this event occur. Now, Jupiter is the biggest planet in our solar system, right? And you've seen pictures of it, and it's been studied extensively by satellites here recently. But in 1992, a comet came past Jupiter within its Roche limit, and it disintegrated. It fell apart, not only probably dumped all of the ice and other materials into Jupiter's atmosphere, and we didn't see that happen. It may have been largely on the backside. But anyway, it went past Jupiter, and the core broke up because Jupiter's gravity is so strong. It wasn't discovered until April 1993 when they were looking for comets, and they found one out here that was like a string of pearls. And it was a very strange kind of comet. It was about two dozen pieces, fragments of a comet all in a row. And as they looked at that and plotted its orbit, its course through the solar system, they realized it had made a close encounter with Jupiter. So they backtracked it and realized that before it was discovered, that it had gone past Jupiter, broken up, and it came to a halt in its orbit away from Jupiter, and then began to go back to Jupiter, and ultimately the pieces one after another impacted Jupiter. Now Jupiter's a gas planet; it's not a solid rocky planet like our Earth, and so these pieces, a mile or 2 mile diameter pieces of this comet, fell into Jupiter's atmosphere and disappeared. I mean, they didn't make a crater or anything, but they made a huge explosion when they hit the gases of Jupiter because they're pretty dense. And so, here's Jupiter, and as Jupiter turns, it's going this way, it's going up. The comet is impacting Jupiter down here at the bottom, just over to the backside of Jupiter, and after the explosion, that's turned into our view. Now, a satellite who was out in the solar system at the time took a picture of one or two of these explosions. I don't have those pictures, but there was a huge explosion when the piece hit the atmosphere of Jupiter, and then you see these scars that are left where the atmosphere turns black or dark brown. And so here was where one hit. Here's another one. Here's another one. Maybe that's a little one that hit there. Another one here. Now, compared to Earth, Earth is about the size of this scar. You can realize if that hit the Earth, it's lights out, people. That hasn't hit the Earth. And we're glad it hasn't. Jupiter was able, in fact, Jupiter probably intercepts a lot of comets this way because of its big gravitational effect, Jupiter and Saturn. So, here's an event where the thing broke apart, circled around, came back and hit the planet. And the same thing could happen to Earth. If a comet like that, or a meteor, or an asteroid, hits the Earth, because it's solid, it makes a crater. Same thing on the moon, as you well are, I'm sure you're well aware. All right. This particular crater, anybody been there? It's within driving distance, isn't it? This is at Winslow, Arizona, and it's well worth it. It's an interesting thing. I took my family to see it, and we climbed down into it partway and looked at it. And it's a very awe-inspiring occasion when you go there. Now there's a visitor center over on this part over here, some buildings and trails you can get down into it. Scientists argue about when that particular piece hit the Earth, and they say 25 to 50,000 years ago. I don't think it was that far back, but nonetheless, a piece of iron core, an iron meteor hit the Earth. It's something like 50 feet across and weighs something like 80,000 pounds. I think that's what I read. And it made a pretty good boom when it hit, as you might imagine. In fact, it made such an explosion and shockwave that it probably killed everything within 50 to 100 miles of the impact site. Now, that takes in nearly all of New Mexico and Arizona. And so Indians probably didn't survive it. And any animals and plants out there didn't survive it either. That was a sizable explosion. So, did this happen in the case of the flood? That supplies us with some extra water for the flood if we do it by natural phenomena. That's all we're saying here. This is a just-so story. It's just a guess. It isn't... But it's logical that something like this might have happened. So here the comet comes zooming by at a high rate of speed, incidentally. These things are running at something on the order of 100,000 miles an hour, much faster, five times as fast as the space station is circling the Earth at, 18,000 miles an hour. So it interacts with the gravity of the Earth, and it does two things. It dumps its ice and gravel and dust into orbit around the Earth, and that's where the water is that was raised above the atmosphere, see? So that nucleates all that water vapor to add to the rain. And the second thing that it does is that in interacting gravitationally with the Earth, it creates volcanoes. It creates earthquake because this is a sizable gravitational structure. And so the Earth buckles as it passes over. You know that the moon passing over our Earth at a great distance out there causes tides in the water. But this thing up close causes tides in the land. And so the land buckles and the slabs of earth that make up the land part of our world were cracked and broken. And then comes out all of the lava from the magma that's underneath. Our land is floating upon liquid rock underneath the land. And so when that's broken, the pressure is such that these things spew out. And so now we have, under the sea, we have volcanoes and also upon the land. And they're spewing ash into the air. And then that's why the sun and the moon were darkened, because the sky is full of ash. And then this, of course, nucleates all of the moisture in the air and adds to the water. So we have a number of sources of water that are designated as the windows of heaven. Okay, it goes by, and so we have volcanoes suddenly appear all over the land and under the sea, and thousands of cubic miles of lava were released into the ocean. They know that happened. The estimates are 15,000 years ago. We talked about the time of the flood, and we're saying 13,000 years ago. I don't think anybody would quibble over a couple of thousand years in that kind of a scenario. So lots of volcanoes everywhere. And then the thing goes around. It disintegrates. It circles around, comes back, and impacts the earth. Now, how do we know that happened? Well, you might recall there was a father-son pair, Alvarez, who won the Nobel Prize for their proposal a few years ago. They proposed this back in the late 70s, early 80s, that the dinosaurs were wiped out by an impact of a comet or an asteroid on the Earth 65 million years ago. That's by their reasoning of the time. And so, how do they know that? Well, there are elements in asteroids and comets that don't occur on the Earth very much. They've been diluted out and maybe settled into the core of the Earth for the heavy metals that we're talking about. And one of these is iridium. Another is osmium. These are unusual elements for our dust, our dirt in our world. So you don't find them on the surface of the Earth, but you find them at one spot in the layering of the Earth. We're going to talk about the layering next week. But it seems that when this thing hit, it disintegrated, scattered all of its dust around the Earth. It all settled out. And one of the layers in the flood layers contains a lot of iridium. And so that suggests that there was a strike. Now, ordinarily, that would have wiped out everything in the world, anything that big. Would have killed, there would have been fires and nuclear winter sort of thing, although there's no radiation associated with it. But the sun would have been blotted out for years and plants couldn't grow and everything would have died. But it happened during the flood, and so everything was wet. And although there was a big explosion and a scattering of a lot more dust, there was already dust in the air from the volcanoes. And it settled in this layer in the flood layers. But nonetheless, nothing burned, you see, because there wasn't any. It's during the flood. And all God had to do was to protect Noah and the ark and everybody within it from the effects of such a collision. I put it hitting Pangaea, but I don't know I don't know where it hit. We know that the one that struck the earth by scientist reasoning 65 million years ago hit down here just off the coast of Mexico, off the Yucatan Peninsula. And it's a crater over 100 miles in diameter, suggesting that the object that hit it, which would have been the core of the comet, would have been 10 miles across. So that's a big one. It was a big hit whenever it occurred. And it left a crater. Part of it is under the Gulf of... Well, it's not the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, I guess it is the Gulf of Mexico, and the other part's on the land in the Mexican Yucatan Peninsula. So the consequences of there's a second consequence of the hit if the thing came around and hit the earth. And that is, we seem to have, before the flood, we looked at the flood calendar. Those of you who've been with us throughout this remember that as you go through the story of the flood, you get some designations of months and years and days here. And we follow that out, and it looks like one key thing was the flood lasted 150 days. That's a half a year if we have a 300-day year. And we see if the rotation of the moon around the earth is 30 days, then that makes an interesting calendar, doesn't it? With 10 months, the circuit of the moon defines the month, and then the number of days defines the year. And so if God set this thing up originally in a very even set of numbers here, then we have an earth which is perfectly aligned with the sun. We have the moon aligned with that, and they're all going around in orderly fashion here the way God set it up originally. And we have a uniform climate. That's what we're looking for here. Maybe 25 hours a day, that makes the math easy. Okay, we don't know. I'm trying to tell you clearly that we're just guessing here. But an asteroid hit of the size we're talking about could knock the Earth off its axis and change its year to 365 days a year. And the interaction with the moon, because the Earth's orbit has changed slightly, could have been changed slightly to make it 29 and a half days like it is now, and 24-hour days. And now we have heat and cold, summer, winter, largely because of the tilt of the axis of the Earth's rotation in relation to the sun, so that we get more sun in the summer and less sun in the wintertime, especially at the poles. So that's another possible complication of the whole story. We're just talking about natural phenomenon and what could be. We don't know that this is the case. These are just guesses. But one guess about where the water went after the flood, it would be in pretty good agreement with all geologists, I think. And that's because of the structure of the earth, that the crust of the earth... Oh, wait a minute. I didn't want to do that. Wrong button. The crust of the earth underneath the continent is thicker than it is underneath the seafloor. And that's this purple line here. And so if we add water to the system and cover all of the land, then the weight of the water on the floor of the oceans and basins is pushing down. We've maybe doubled the weight there. And so because it's floating on a magma layer underneath, we have liquid down here, liquid rock. The pressure of it going down has kind of a seesaw effect here. As the ocean basin subsides, then it can hold more water. But as it does so, it also pushes up on the land mass, and that raises... You see, that raises mountains on the shores of the oceans. So that's a phenomenon called isostatic readjustment. And I guess a geologist would recognize that term. It's unique to me. But anyway, that's what they call it. So that's where the water went. I mean, the basins just simply deepen because of the weight of the water that's in them, and then the water has a place to go. So that's not as big a problem as a lot of people make it out to be. Now, next week, our time's just about gone. Next week we're going to talk about the layers of rock. We're going to talk about geology next week. And the pain is nearly over. We've only got two more weeks to go. So don't. Those of you who are struggling to keep up in a talk like this, we're going to talk about fossils, because fossils tell the scientists what the layers are, and by their reckoning, it tells them how old the layers are, you see. And so this is one of the cruxes of the matter about evolution. And as you talk to your kids in high school about this, you need to have at least a rudimentary understanding of what they're discussing here. And so next week, we'll talk about the Grand Canyon. Has anybody ever been to the Grand Canyon? It's a beautiful sight, isn't it? And if you haven't been, take your kids. It's interesting. They will give you an evolution story about the Grand Canyon and tell you that it took millions of years to produce, but I'm going to show you some evidence that it doesn't take that long, okay? Now, we already know there was a flood. We already know there's a boat, a ship. We have plenty of evidence of that all of this really did occur. If we didn't have that evidence, then their argument versus our argument is you just take your pick. But scientifically, you can't do that if you know there was a flood of the volume that we're talking about here, because it's going to create a lot of water-laid strata in the ground underneath us, and essentially all of these layers were laid in water, and they contain organisms that came out of the ocean. So we'll start there next week, and if you got a brochure about the Grand Canyon, you might review that before we come. We're not looking so much at Scripture in this. Remember, we're talking about how it might have happened if God used natural phenomena. And to recap there, keeping the wind from blowing in the world before the flood would have required a miracle of sorts. The timing of a hit by a comet is something that God brought about. And so timing of these events is miraculous, and that's important for us to keep track of. But it could have happened, you see. It's not impossible that something, a series of events like this occurred. And when you talk to someone, they say, well, that's ridiculous. It can't happen. No, it can happen. Thank you very much.